While we're waiting, so just to review some ideas, somebody asked me, they had a little trouble with the last one. Is it too hot? Can you check? The other guy was trying to make a distinction. He was talking about habits that you had from your last life or your last 10,000 lives and bad habits that you picked up in this life, right? And he was trying to make the point that habits that you picked up in your last life or that you came into this life with must be harder to get rid of than ones that you picked up in this life. In this life, habits that maybe came from hanging around with bad people or something like that. Oh, wow, that's the way. So he was trying to make a distinction between those two. And then he was saying, you could use lower ideas to get rid of bad habits you've accumulated in this life, maybe from being around other people. And then you could use the higher ideas to get rid of the habits that came from your past life, okay? Which are more in, what do you call it? Ingrained or incalcitrant? Or what's that word?
Intractable.
Yeah. They're hard to get rid of. Let's see if he's ready yet. No. Not responding. All right. Then we said, let's say, for example, that from your past lives, you had a habit of thinking that you had control over your own body and mind in the present moment. Okay? Do you have control over your body and mind in the future?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can plant new karma seeds, and then you can control what happens in the future. But you can't control what happens in this moment. Okay? I like to think of the future as something like wet concrete, and you can still make changes, right? But the present moment, you can't change it. It's like dry concrete. You can't do anything about it, right? And as your understanding gets deeper and deeper, you can shorten the time gap between, you know, how fast the seeds will grow. But still there's some time gap, all right? You cannot control, you don't have any control over what's happening to your body and mind in the present moment. If I hold up this object, you will see it as a pen. You have seeds in your mind to see it as a pen. It's too late to try to put other seeds in your mind. Once I hold it up and you see a pen, those seeds are ripening, and if you want to see it as a sword for cutting out the suffering of the world, then you will have to wait a while. All right? It doesn't happen in the present moment. We don't have control of body and mind in the present moment. So he says, but you come into this life with a belief that you have control of your body and mind. And then it's reinforced during this life, you know? So he was trying to say that, let's say that you went to a teaching at the Unity Church of Mesa, and some guy got up and said, and explained, you know, look, you don't really have control over what's happening in the present moment. So just chill out a bit already. You know, don't get so upset. When you get into traffic on Route 60 to Phoenix or there's an accident, don't freak out. There's not much you can do. That's the present moment. You don't have control over it. That's a useful thought, but it doesn't solve the problems of the world. It just makes you more calm with the problems that are happening. The higher teachings are meant to remove those problems before they happen. If you master the higher teachings, if you master meditation, if you get good at your yoga, etc., you will just never get in a traffic jam. And then you don't have to worry about being calm about it, all right? That's the idea. So our response to him, I was talking to Ningbo at dinner. We went to Guru Palace. It was a palace, sort of. Then he said, so really, our answer to that guy is that you can't get rid of either one with that kind of attitude. You see, by someone teaching you that you're not in charge of your body and mind, right? By someone teaching you that, you can get rid of your habit of thinking that you are in charge of your body and mind. Whether you got it from your past lives or you got that bad idea from your present life, temporarily you can overcome that habit of thinking like that. But the idea that you're not in charge of your body and mind will never get rid of the seeds in your own mind which are causing you to think that way, all right? You can't make a permanent change in your mind with that kind of attitude. It's a coping attitude, right? I will cope with the problems that come to me. That kind of attitude will never remove the root of the problems in your mind. Okay? So like that. That's our answer to him. Whether those problems came from your past life or your present life, you're not getting rid of them. You're just coping with them. All right? Here we go. Just like the machine I had in 1980. Cutting your eyes is from the. Yeah. Here you go. We were talking about, I'm just reviewing from this afternoon, we were talking about how having a wrong idea about the things around you leads you to hurt other people and collect bad karma, alright? So if you understood the things around you, you wouldn't do things which hurt other people, okay? So really, if you want to make your world pure, if you want to live in a perfect world, you have to stop doing harm to other people. But until such time as you understand how the world came to be and where the world comes from, you will always harm other people. You won't be able to stop. Not harming other people is not done through some kind of extreme self-control. Not harming other people is accomplished by understanding how things work in the world. Okay? If you understand that the last person to hurt you in a serious way came to you because you hurt someone else in this similar way, then your reactions would only be to be kinder and to be nicer and to not hurt people. You see, you can only react with violence to violence if you don't understand where the first violence came from. Once you understand where things come from, you would, in order to escape the violence, you would not want to be violent. You see? So understanding is the only way out of that cycle of responding to problems, responding to being hurt by trying to hurt the other person. When you understand where things are coming from, finally, and really strongly in your own mind, you don't have to control yourself anymore. You just would never want to hurt anybody, you see? Because that would cause you to have problems, and you would understand that. Understanding is the key, all right? So, so he's talking about an active feeling. Let's say the last time you felt really bad when someone hurt you badly, right? That's an active feeling. Someone, let's say your boss at work criticized you, right? Somebody's, Benjamin Franklin said, the tongue bone doth lack, but a single stroke can recommend back. Something like that. It hurts a lot, right? It hurts almost more than being struck physically to be criticized strongly by someone that you care about, let's say, for example. So you have to, then when they criticize you, you get a bad feeling. You feel bad, you feel hurt, right? There are three elements going on in that event. There's someone criticizing you, right? There's someone who's being criticized, which is you. And there's the criticizing itself, the words from the criticizer coming to the criticizee. There's all three, they call the three elements in an active feeling. Someone who makes you feel bad, you there to feel bad, and the things they're saying which make you feel bad, the feeling bad, all right? None of those is real. In the way that you thought they were, each of them is unreal. Why? They are not happening on the outside, and they are not coming from the outside, and they're not coming from their side. They're coming from you. All right? Who brought the person in the room to criticize you? You did. Yeah, your seeds rising in your mind. Because you criticized someone in the past, all right? Who brought you in the room to be criticized? You did, because you spoke to someone in the past in a negative way. And who caused the bad feeling starting in your heart when the person criticized you? This is also because you criticized someone in the past. None of the components of that event is coming from its own side. All of the components of that event are coming from your side. Right? So they are unreal. They're not what they seem. Unreal means they are not what they seem. It seems like your boss is yelling at you. The truth is, you've created a person to yell at you. All right. So does there even exist a boss yelling at you?
Yes.
They exist. Does there exist a boss yelling at you who comes from his own side?
No.
No. You see, in that case, in a normal day, in a normal office, in normal interactions with people who are criticizing you, you are dealing with phantoms. You are dealing with things that don't even exist, you see? You are, the person who bugged you the most in the world is a phantom. They don't even exist, you see? The person who bothers you the most in the world is not real. They're not there. Because you think they're coming from their side. And you think if you talk to them and explain to them why you didn't make a mistake on the last task they gave you at work, then they should stop criticizing you. But that doesn't work, and you know it. They're coming from you. If you don't like being criticized by your boss at work or by your husband or by anybody else, then you just have to stop criticizing other people. That's all. And that's the only way. There is no other way. Because you've tried talking to people who criticize you and they didn't get it. And you've also tried the passive aggressive thing where you just be quiet and then they just keep criticizing you. Alright? Or maybe they stop, or maybe they stop. You see, it's those methods are not methods because they don't work. Because they only work sometimes. Alright? Here we go. What I'm trying to say is that it's bad enough that the whole world is surrounded, is threatened by phantoms. You see? Everything bad in your life isn't what you thought it was. Alright? It's bad enough that people feel bad. It's bad enough that people suffer in the world. But what's worse is that none of it is necessary. That it was all just a big boo-boo. You see? I don't know how to say it. It's bad to see a child burn their hand on a stove. It's even worse to know they didn't have to. You know? Alright? It's bad to see the suffering of the world. But it's worse to know that all the suffering, the anxiety that people have is over nothing. The things they're anxious about, or the things they hate, or the things they're fighting against, they don't exist. Alright? They're just non-existent. Right? It's like somebody at work sees you whispering to another person at work. Right? This happened to me all the time. I was in corporate life for 20 years. I was a boss, right? 800 employees. So in my office in New York. So people, you know, they would see me with, I built my office out of glass. And I put it in the middle of the factory floor, you know? Because I wanted to be transparent. And it was fun. So they could see if I was working or not. I built it in the middle of the floor. Everyone could watch me. So they would see me call somebody in and they would see me talking to them. And then everybody would be trying to guess what I was saying. And then there were examples where I brought somebody in the office, I sat them down, I closed the door, and I said, how can we get more money for this person's salary? You know, can you give me some suggestions of how we can adjust the budget to get this person a raise because they're really doing a good job? And then the person that I'm trying to get the money for would come in after half an hour and say, I saw you talking to so-and-so, and are you going to promote them over me? You know, what's going on? You know, and they get all scared, they get all nervous. You know, or after work, they grab me after work at the door of the company, and we walk down the street and they're like, okay, so when am I getting fired? You know, tell me when I'm getting fired. I saw you talking to my supervisor, you know. So what, you know, what's going on? You know, when are you firing me? And then, it's bad enough, what do you call it? It's bad enough that they have the worry, right? That's a bad thing. That's a sad thing. But the fact that the object that they're worried about doesn't exist is even worse, right? Every concern, every anxiety, every fear, and every hatred you ever felt was the same. Because the person you felt it towards, or the event, or the news that you felt it about, didn't exist the way you thought it did. Alright? So it's bad enough that the world has all this suffering and pain and anxiety. But what's more sad is they're having it over things that don't exist. They are just like the person who thinks they're going to get fired when you're trying to give them a raise. Alright? Everybody who ever had a problem on this planet for the last 50,000 years of recorded history was having a problem about something that didn't exist at all. And that's sad. That's really sad. Alright? So that's what he's saying. They can hear me. By the way, just to repeat, those of you who weren't here this afternoon, we're in the middle of a class that has gone for 7 years already. This is one of the most difficult texts in all of Buddhism. And I'm just doing it during this week because a lot of my students, the old-time students, are here. And I promised them I would finish this book. And we have another 12, 14 years to go on this book. And I'm just fulfilling a promise I made to them. So don't expect to get everything and don't stress. And then you can still come back tomorrow and catch the class on meditation. All right, this is just a, like, you just walked into algebra, all right? And don't get stressed and don't think, oh, I that stuff's not for me, all right? I'm just keeping a promise to some older students to finish this book in the next 20 years or so. And, you know, I didn't want them to think I had given up. So this today's classes were reserved for that. So you're welcome to sit there and be confused. But don't let it discourage you from coming tomorrow to the real class, okay? We're just sort of having a little tea party here. Okay, you have misunderstood the meaning of the question. So he's trying to make a certain distinction. He says a lower view of the world, where you say, I can't control stuff, so I should just chill a little bit. All right, that's a lower view. What's a higher view? Stop coping with the problems of the world. Understand that they are coming from the seeds that you plant within your own mind. And then do what you have to do to stop planting those seeds. Stop problems before they ever come to you, and stop trying to cope with them. Stop going to psychiatrists, psychologists, to tell them how to, so then they can tell you how to cope with your spouse or your job or whatever. Just plant different seeds that your spouse is perfect, and your job is perfect, and the traffic flow in Phoenix is perfect. And then you don't need to pay some psychiatrist to tell you how to cope with it. All right? The lower view is coping. The higher view is manipulating reality itself so that you don't have these problems, okay? If you haven't been to a psychiatrist in the last year, It's because certain problems didn't happen to you. All right? And we just want to keep that up. All right. This is tough. Okay, let me think about this. Okay, so if you come to a talk, and I'm sorry, I gotta change one thing. If you come to a talk and a person stands up and starts describing how you're not really in control of your body and mind, right? You're not in control of your body because you're going to get cancer or some other disease and you can't stop it. In the present moment. You can't wish that you didn't have cancer. It doesn't work, alright? Same thing with your mind. If you get sad or if you get depressed or if you have doubts about your life or other mental kinds of anxiety, you can't, by sheer willpower, make those go away, alright? You can't say to your mind, let's not be depressed tonight. Can you wait till tomorrow? All right. If you've been depressed, you know that doesn't work. All right. So those are two indications that you don't really have control in the current moment over your body and mind. So if I come along and say, look, you're going to get sad sometimes, and you're going to get sick sometimes, and you can't control it. So just chill a little bit, you know, try to be a little bit patient about it, because those things happen and you can't control them. So for the time being, meaning temporarily, you will be okay with that. It'll make you feel better for a while, right? And then you'll get sick more, or right? Or you'll get more depressed, and then that kind of advice won't last. That kind of advice is not going to help you in the sixth month of your of a solid depression. Don't worry so much, it just happens, all right? That kind of advice isn't helpful in the long run, right? That's what he's saying here. In the short run, for the time being, reishi, that kind of advice can help you, but in the long run, okay? I can tell you that you should try to be calm about the bad things that happen to you because you can't really control them, alright? And then it'll make you feel alright for a while. But it doesn't work in the long run. It does not remove the seeds for feeling that you should have some control, that you would like to have control, alright? You will be upset again a week later after you forget what I said, And you'll be frustrated about the traffic, or about your own health, or about your body getting older, or about your mind getting slower, and you will be frustrated, and you will try to eat vitamins, or, you know, do more yoga, or like that, go on a different diet. You will struggle against something that you can't control, all right? Because my telling you that you don't control these things, even if I seem very reasonable and convincing, will wear off, because it doesn't affect the seeds for thinking that way, okay? All right? Is there something that does affect the seeds for thinking that way? You see? Is there some kind of idea that if I teach it to you, you can remove the seeds for misunderstanding everything? All right? That's the question. That's where we are. All right? Is Michael Michael? Is Michael Michael?
Yes.
Is Michael Michael?
Yes.
You would say yes, right? I mean, I'm not Cat, right? I'm Michael, right? Is Michael Michael? You would say yes, right? Or not? You gotta say something or you can't go home. Is Michael Michael?
Bye, Michael. Huh?
Oh, the guy who's standing up here and talking to me.
Yeah. So we have a different label based on our perspective.
Is the guy that you came to the talk to listen to the guy that you came to the talk to listen to?
Yes.
You can say yes. Is he Michael? Wrote. Yeah, he is. But now what you said comes, okay? Is he Michael from his own side?
No.
No, he's not, all right? He's not Michael from his own side. Is he saying something meaningful?
Yes.
Is what he's saying important? Well, that's a relative thing. That's what you're saying, right?
I mean, it depends on.
Yeah, it depends on who's listening. For some people, it's interesting. So some people, it's not. Right? Some people think, "Oh, this could save my life," and other people are like, "Is he going to get to anything like substantial?" No, it's true. It's true. It's a long day. You're tired, and you're wondering if this is going anywhere. Right? So that means that the words I'm saying don't have a quality of being important in them, right? This afternoon we talked about the word in. There's nothing in my words which is important. If you perceive them as important, that's because you perceive them as important. And if you don't think they're important, that's because you don't perceive them as important. So we can say that my words are neither important nor unimportant by themselves. It just depends on who's looking, right? And who, how you feel about what you're hearing, right? So if Michael's words are neither important nor unimportant, is Michael Michael?
Then when you stop, you can go.
Are my words my words?
Yes.
only if the person perceiving them chooses to label them as such.
Yeah, only if... Well, chooses is a difficult word. We could say forced to, by the season in life. If the person... Like if I spoke these words to Bella, she wouldn't even conceive of them as words, per se. You see? An infant wouldn't conceive of them as words. They would be similar to other sounds in the room. They wouldn't cognize them as words. So even my words, I think we can say even my words aren't words. Forget if they're interesting or not, or important or not. I think we can even say my words aren't words to everybody. Right? It depends on the observer. And then you just switch that over to Michael. All right? In the end, you have to come to realize that you are not you. In the way you thought you were. Okay, you are you. You still have to have breakfast tomorrow. You still have to find a place to sleep tonight, etc. But who you feel you are and how you experience yourself in your life is coming from how you treat other people. Alright? So, you are not you independent of how you treat other people. Which is to say, you are not you without other people. Alright? You can't be who you want to be unless there are other people to be kind to so that you can see yourself become what you would like to be. So in a sense, other people become for us indispensable. You know? We need other people around. I have friends, they say, I don't want to go to that place because there's other people there. And I'm like, well, how are you ever going to make karma? You know, you need other people. You should be around other people. If you can, not be angry with them. Because these are, you need them to collect karma. You need to be around lots of people to collect karma. Right? You need other people. We need other people. All right? They are what make us ourselves. And without other people, we are not ourselves. All right? I am not Michael without you. All right? Okay. How a person is not themselves. How's that? Okay. This gets into a Buddhist thing. They talk about things and people. All right. They talk about things and people. In the study of how we misunderstand things, they talk about misunderstanding me, and then misunderstanding things. But things in that context refer to the parts of me. Okay? So in this context, when we say, you are misunderstanding me, or you are misunderstanding things, the things means your arms, your legs, your mind, your, okay, the other parts of you. All right? Why do they make this distinction? The thing which causes us the most pain in the world is misunderstanding what?
Me.
Okay? And you have to personalize that. You have to say, Kevin, or Michael, or Nicole, or Darcy. The thing that causes Darcy the most suffering in the world is the misunderstanding of
Darcy.
The thing that causes Michael the most suffering in the world is the misunderstanding of
Michael,
okay? This is the hardest nut to crack in the whole universe, okay? They say that when you start studying how things really are, you should not start with yourself because it's too difficult. Why? Whose hair have you combed your whole life? Right? What's the score between combing your own hair and combing other people's hair? You know, over the length of your life, it's like 30,000 to zero, right? For me, I don't know. I mean, anyway. So we have this irrational and incredibly powerful attachment to ourselves. We cannot be objective about Michael. You know, we get crazy. If something starts to affect Michael, we go crazy. You know, trying to discuss the real nature of Michael is like the last thing I should work on. Because I'm blind to everything about Michael. Michael is selfish. Michael is self-centered. You know, Michael doesn't listen to anybody. Michael continually interrupts people. Michael goes through life trampling things and people to look like a good person. And, you know, he'll never get it. And I can't talk to him. But I can examine Michael's parts. That gets a little more impersonal, you know. I can say, why does my arm look like that? Or you know, why did I get a hot chocolate today? Why did I get 3 hot chocolates today? It's really bad. Because sometimes I don't get any hot chocolate. And then I got 3 in one day and I can't possibly drink them all. Like, why did these things happen to Michael? If I can get it a little bit far from me, then I can examine those pieces of me, like we talked about the
swamp cooler.
Yeah, we talked about taking apart a swamp cooler to fix it, right? And you understand it better after you take it apart. Before you fix the swamp cooler, you are just sitting in your room staring at it and hating it. Because it's the middle of the summer, you're supposed to be doing a translation, and the swamp cooler is not working. And you just stare at this box and you hate it. And you don't know what's inside the box. You've never opened it. As far as you know, you open it up and it looks like a Ferrari inside. Like, you don't know that the whole thing is empty and there's one little $14 pump at the bottom. You know? Then you take it apart and then you start to understand it, right? You can hate the box, but once you open it up and see all the little parts in it and they're not so difficult, then you stop hating it, right? You don't feel so strongly about the pump as you do about the swamp cooler before you start taking it apart. So in the practice of meditation, in the discovery of who you really are, we start with the pieces of you and we don't start with Kevin or Michael or Darcy or Rob. We never start with me. We start with the parts of me. Those parts in this section of the text are called
things.
All right.
Thank you.
So, technical stuff. Is it more important to stop misunderstanding? Well, is it more important to stop misunderstanding Michael, or is it more important to stop misunderstanding Michael's part? I'll say it again. Is it? Don't do a big yawn. It knocks me off. Okay. Or look down. Okay. Mama Aura used to do that to me. It was terrible. Anyway, is it more important to stop misunderstanding Michael, or is it more important to stop misunderstanding Michael's parts? What do you think?
Michael's parts, because Michael's parts make up.
What's he saying?
Right.
What's he saying in the last sentence? They're equal. I mean, in the end, you're going to have to understand both of those things. Is it more important to understand the Swamko or the parts of the Swamko? I mean, it's equal. You're going to have to understand both of them sooner or later to fix it, right? Okay. Okay, forget it. I mean, don't try to figure out the English, all right? That's the thing that I said about, are my words interesting? Are my words important? Are my words important from their own side? No, I mean, some people will take them as important, and some people will take them as unimportant, all right? And that's an indicator. You see, those are a part of me. Those words are a part of me. If you understand something about the words, you can apply it to Michael, even if you feel strongly about Michael because you've come to this area your whole life. Got it? So are my words important from their own side?
No.
Then am I Michael from my own side? See, you have to make that, that's what he's saying. The logic for deciding whether the words are important or not is exactly the same as the logic for deciding whether Michael is Michael or not. If one is not something from its own side, neither will the other be, even if you love him dearly because you combed his hair your whole life. Right? Okay? So you go at him from the back. You don't say, Michael, you're not Michael. Because he's combed his hair his whole life and he's very attached to being Michael. Spent his whole life protecting Michael's interests. Okay? At the expense of other people's. And we all did. Okay? So you don't go at it that way. You pick something about Michael. His words. Are they important from their own side? No. So is Michael Michael? Then you sneak it really fast to him before he gets to realize you're talking about Michael. It's like that red light, green light thing. You say, okay, so is Michael the words important from their own side? I say, no. Is Michael important from their own side? No. Wait. Alright? Okay? That's all. That's the exercise. Don't worry, we're almost done with this section and then the next one's worse. Okay. Okay, those of you who are old hardcore Mighty Meekans, while I take a sip of my hot chocolate, because the other two have gone down a bit. What's cheek to down? What's cheek to down? Huh? Cheek is one. You gotta start. What's Tuma? Tuma? Tuma means many. Say chick. Two. Yeah. Chick to tell. What's chick to tell? Tell means toma. Chick to tell. Tell means toma. Huh? Yeah, the fact that things are neither one nor many is chick to tell. Okay? Chick to tell. That's one of the most famous proofs for emptiness ever given. All right? If you say, name the five most important proofs of emptiness, cheek to tell is up there in the top five. Okay? What does cheek to tell mean? Tell means divorced from or not having. Cheek means one, do means duma means many. Things are neither one nor many. Is this one pen or many pens? So it's not true to say it's neither one nor many. Am I right? Just be, don't, yeah. I'm not tricking you much. Okay. Is this one or many?
It's many parts.
I'm not asking about the parts. I didn't ask if the parts and the pen were many. Is the pen one or one pen or two pens?
One pen.
It's one pen. So is it correct to say it's neither one nor many?
Yes.
No, it's not correct because it is either one nor many because it's? One. That's all. I'm not trying to say anything. Geshe Michael is not Geshe Michael, is the pen the pen? Maybe I am tricking you. If Geshe Michael is not Geshe Michael, is the pen the pen? I'm asking you. It's not the pen. Because it's not the pen you thought it was. That's all. Alright? That's the punchline. It's not complicated. Okay? Is this the pen? Yes. Is the pen a pen? No. Why not? Because it isn't the pen you thought was there. Why not? Because I always thought the pen was just out there no matter what I was doing. You know, I could be nice to my sister, I could be mean to my sister, but the pen is always, it's not going to change whether the pen is a pen. But now you know different, right? This pen is not coming from inside. This pen is coming from your own mind. This pen is coming from the seed of a pen. That seed of a pen was planted in your mind when you gave the pen to someone else. In the moment that I, he's a All-American lacrosse player. I'm just a clunk. In the moment that I offer another person the pen, I plant a seed in my mind, in my subconscious for a pen. In fact, for many pens, multiple pens. Because all seeds grow in the mind. I mean, all these plants came from a single seed, right? All the flowers in each container, each of the blooms has, 30, 40 seeds in it, right? But all of the blooms together and all of the seeds together, meaning hundreds of seeds, they all came from one seed in each container, right? So if I give Mr. LaCrosse a single pen, that's better. If I give him a single pen, I plant a seed in my mind for to see many pens in the future, all right? So how many pens were there in my hand before that came from themselves? One or many?
One.
You should say bad question. Okay, I'll say it again. How many pens in my hand were there, one or many, which come from their own side? And don't come from being kind to other people.
Zero.
You can just say zero, right? There's no such thing. So can we say cheap to draft? Can we say this pen is neither one nor many?
Yes.
In that sense, you can. In that sense, you can. A pen which came from its own side without you being nice to someone else is neither one pen nor many pens. Because it doesn't exist. Alright? That's all. That's all. It's a very famous proof of emptiness. Okay? How many pens? How many pens?
42.
No, that's a good answer. It's a silly answer, and that's my question silly also, so it deserves some of Yeah, how many pens in my hand of the kind that you used to think were there?
Two.
How many pens are in my hand of the kind that don't come from being nice to other people? None, okay? Now how many pens in my hand of the kind that don't come from being nice to other people? Still none. Good. Whoever said still, that's good. That's a nice addition, okay? That's cheek to dough. Got it? That's cheek to dough. That's an ancient argument for emptiness, alright? If there cannot be one pen that existed in the way you used to think, how could you have two? I mean, once you've established that there's not, once you've established that it's impossible to have one pen which you can get without being kind to someone else, once you've established that there cannot be a single pen which you can get without serving someone else, then what about two pens? It's just a dumb question, because that's just double zero. Got it? That's all. It's a famous argument for emptiness. If you can't get one pen from not being nice to other people, why talk about two? Alright? Got it? Okay. That's cheap to do. How many pens I got? Let's see, okay, there's many types of reasoning, such as the one where the current of the gas may be on. And apply them to things and to people. Right? things. That's the nature of the requirement. Okay, this is tough. Buddhists have this idea of a thing called emptiness, and we talked about it already. And we talked about it this afternoon, but if you were here this afternoon or the last 7 years, then you have to go away again. Is there a pen in my hand?
Yes.
I mean, don't be fancy, okay? There is a pen in my hand. If you don't think so, come up and I'll give you a Saddam Hussein mustache. Okay? There is a pen in my hand. Is there a pen in my hand which I obtained without being kind to other people?
No.
There's no. Okay. There is not such a pen in my head. In my head, right? Are we right?
Yes.
Could there ever be such a pen?
No.
Is that okay? Got that?
Yes.
But when I first held up in the class, and before we talked about how you get pens. By giving pens to other people and then putting a seed in your mind and that allows you to see a pen, right? When I held the pen up at the beginning of class, and we didn't talk about it yet, did I have a pen in my hand?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a pen in my hand. You just misunderstood where it came from, right? Maybe. Alright?
Mm-hmm.
At that time, was there a pen in my hand that came without helping other people?
No.
Did you think there was?
Yes.
Good. The pen that you were seeing at the beginning of class, and in the back of your consciousness, you were thinking, that's just there. And you weren't thinking, that came because he was kind to someone else, right? That pen is the thing which emptiness is empty of. Okay? The word emptiness in Buddhism, you know, you say, you go to the Guru Palace on, what's that street?
Baseline.
No.
Gilbert.
It's probably Gilbert and Baseline, actually. You go to the Guru Palace Indian restaurant on Gilbert. You know, and you order a nice small dinner that covers the whole table. And then you eat it all, or as much as you can. And then the guy says, that'll be, you know, X dollars. And then you reach into your pocket, you open your wallet, and you remember that you left your credit card at the post office or something, all right? Like, you reach for your credit card and it's not there. That's emptiness, all right? Why? Something you expected to be there wasn't there. We have a special word in Buddhism for that thing. What you expected to be there that didn't turn out to be there is called
Gartha.
Gartha means the thing that's not there that you thought was there. Alright? Gartha means the thing that you thought was there that turned out not to be there. Alright? In the case of the pen, it's a pen that was just there without you ever having to be nice to anybody else. Alright? And what's the ontological status of the Gartha? Does it exist or does it not exist?
Not
it doesn't. There was no such thing. And there never was any such thing. And there will never be any such thing. Alright? Now, let's move it to the person who bugs you the most. Because what's the use of talking about all this stuff if you don't apply it to your life and your happiness? What's the use of standing here and translating Tibetan text if you can't apply it at home or your job? What's the use? You know, why come? Let's apply it to your boss, okay, or your husband, all right, who's always complaining, all right? You're always complaining husband, all right? Is he a husband who is always complaining?
Yes.
He is. He is. Come on, you know better. Okay? Your husband who is always complaining is a husband who is always complaining. I mean, you know that. It's true. It's true. We all know it's true. Is he an always complaining husband who is coming from his own side, or is he an always complaining husband who is coming because you are complaining? Which one? Which one is this? Yeah, it's this one. Alright? What does that imply about the always complaining husband who didn't come because you are always complaining? He doesn't exist. I would go further. He never did exist. He doesn't exist now, and he will never exist in the future. And he couldn't exist. Okay? He could not exist. He never was in your house. He never stood in your kitchen before. He's not standing in your kitchen now. And he will not be in your kitchen tomorrow. Because he can't be in your kitchen. Because he doesn't exist. Okay? That one doesn't exist. Alright? The husband, that's gacha. Gacha means he's the credit card that you left at the post office that you're looking for in the Indian Blue Palace restaurant. Okay? No, he's not there. And he can't be there because it's at the post office. Alright? You're looking in your wallet, he's not there. Alright? The whole thing we're talking about tonight is looking for stuff that's not there. And it's not just not there, it couldn't be there. Okay? Because there's no such thing. A complaining husband who's not coming from your complaining doesn't exist and couldn't exist. All right? Does that improve your marriage?
Yes.
Could it improve your marriage?
Yes. Maybe not instantly.
Yeah, I mean, almost, maybe not instantly, but... No, but the idea can improve your marriage. Can I say that? The idea will eventually improve your marriage if you can keep your mind on it. If you can keep it in mind. So next time he complains, will you complain back?
Yes.
No. Why? Because you want to get rid of him. Okay? It's the best strategy. You don't need a gun or anything. Okay?
But you said we had to fix the marriage before we had divorce.
Yeah. That comes later. That's going to haunt me. I feel like that's going to haunt me. The husband who's complaining from his own side and who's not your fault doesn't exist and never did exist. Now, but understand something further, which is what I was trying to get to earlier tonight, but I had trouble. It was hard for me to explain it. You've been angry at something that did not exist. You've been upset. You've been talking to yourself in your mind. You've been losing sleep. You've been considering expensive divorce arrangements. You've been doing all this stuff towards a person who never existed. And that's the incredible sad thing about the whole world. The whole world, all the problems of every single one of the 6 billion people of the world, all the anxiety, the collective anxiety of the entire planet, is towards things that never existed. You know, it's one thing to be scared about a lion or a car coming at you or AIDS or something like that, but to be scared about something that doesn't exist, to hate something that doesn't exist, to consider expensive divorce arrangements towards someone who doesn't even exist, this is sad. This is a tragedy. This is a tragedy on a global level. It's really a tragedy. It's tragic. It's truly tragic, right? People are upset towards things that don't exist. You know, it's one thing to be upset about something, you know, bad, but you're upset about something that couldn't exist. A husband who could be complaining without you complaining couldn't exist. And you spent decades. I had a lady, it was really sad. You want to hear a sad story? She used to come to my classes, and she was an older lady. And she was constantly looking worried and upset, and, you know, like the world was weighing on her. And she looked sad and drawn and heavy, you know? Then she She came one time to class, and she was like radiant. You know, she was all like, hi. You know, and then I heard from somebody that her husband died the week before. You know, and I told her, I said, I heard your husband passed away. And she's like, yeah. You know, and I'm like, how long were you married? And she said, 30 years. You know, and I'm like, it really hurt me. You know, it really, really hurt me. And she's a good person, you know. But all those 30 years, she was feeling bad. And she was tortured by this relationship. And she was a good Catholic, and she couldn't leave it. And, you know, they had kids and all that. And then he passed away, and you could feel the joy bubbling out of her. And it felt so bad to me. Because all the bad feeling that she had for the 30 years before that was directed at a husband who
didn't exist
and couldn't exist. You see? So all those wasted years, you know, 30 wasted years towards something which never existed. You see? If he existed, it'd be okay. But towards someone who never even existed, now that's sad, right? Could she have had the same heaviness and sadness about her life if she had understood that he was this one? If she had understood that a complaining husband can only come from a wife who's complaining, could she still have the same heaviness in her life? It's not possible. It's not possible. She would simply
stop complaining.
By the way, it doesn't have to be about your husband, all right? You could be complaining about somebody at work and then come home and your husband will be complaining. All right? Karma is exchangeable to that extent. All right? The same is true about fixing it. All right? If you are into a situation at home with your spouse which is just too heavy and too old and too chronic to deal with, like, he's always complaining and that causes you to complain and you're both just basically bitching at each other all the time, which many relationships come to, you can break the cycle elsewhere. The cycle at home with your husband can be broken at work. And you don't have to say anything to your husband, all right? You can watch your mouth, watch your tongue, be extremely careful about not complaining at work, and that karma will come around and express itself to your husband. You see? You don't have to talk to your husband. You don't have to go to a marriage counselor. You don't have to have heart-to-heart talks online. You don't have to do the passive-aggressive thing and not talk to him on purpose. You can just go to work and be careful not to complain about fellow workers, and that will change your husband's complaining, all right? Because this husband exists. And that one who's complaining is only complaining as long as you complain. When you turn off the faucet for the fountain, you know, there's a fountain, which is his complaining. And then you shut it off by stopping your own complaining. And then he just whoop, it just whoop, and he stops complaining. Okay? It's really cool. Right? That husband exists. Good? Why did I get into husbands? Yeah, anyway. Whether or not that husband exists, or whether his leg and arms and hands exist, it's all the same. The reasoning for determining whether the husband you're mad at exists or not is the same as determining whether the words he speaks exist or not. All right? If you establish that his words are not unpleasant from their own side, you can therefore conclude that he is not unpleasant from his own side, and that it must be coming from you. All right? Okay. These are the real applications of spiritual texts. Okay? It's not something you just go to a church and you leave it at the church. If you cannot use it at home, there's no reason to come here. Right? If you cannot use it at work, there's no reason to come here. Okay, here we go. You want to take a break? Yeah, it's late. Let's take a break for like 5-10 minutes. I'll talk to anybody who wants to complain about their husband. and then we'll start again. Okay, and we won't stay very long. Okay, we'll start. Again, this is an advanced class that's been going on for 7 or 8 years. It's meant to help people learn Tibetan. If you stumbled in here by accident, don't freak out. Come back tomorrow for the regular class, okay? And then if that sounds stupid, you can just leave, all right? Okay, but if this sounds stupid, just hang in there, all right? I have a note someone asked me to announce, and I'm quite happy to make announcements about projects that everyone's working on or events that you're working on. Or just tell me, I'm happy to announce them, all right? There's a drug and alcohol rehab center in Chandler Valley that is supposed to be one of the best in the nation, okay? And they are very open. They have contacted us and said, would you be willing to start a yoga program for people in the rehab center? And one of my goals of having us start in Phoenix is to serve the community in a hands-on way. You can meditate and you can, you can help the world a lot just by understanding things in your meditation. I'm of the school of thought that you have to be doing something physical also. You know, like you gotta do some kind of hands-on help of real people for your high meditations to work, you know? Like a certain amount of cleaning bedpans is really good for meditation. So if anyone's interested in helping, I know there's a lot of people here who've had some yoga training. If you're like intermediate skill in yoga, you can teach a small class at a drug rehab center. Maybe we could coordinate some people to teach there. And so I'd like you to talk to Kathy Greig. Greig or Greig? Greig. So she's there. She lives in Chandler. And if you're interested, and I'll announce it again tomorrow and on the weekend, because a lot of people are flying in for this class on the weekend and not during the week. Okay, so. Also, probably on Sunday, we have a prison program nearby, and we visit the prison and we teach yoga and meditation and we teach philosophy to the prisoners. And we've been doing that for about 10 years in different prisons, and more, 15 years. So the response is very, very beautiful, and they're very, very good students. They don't have anywhere to go. We had two programs. I participated in two programs. One was a DWI camp, which was an old motel with a barbed wire fence around it. And they were just there for 2 weeks or 3 weeks for DWI, for driving while they were drunk. And they were terrible students. Then I was at another facility in Douglas, which was 20 years to life. Those guys are good students. You know, they have nowhere to go. No one wants to talk to them. No one wants to visit them. They're going to be there for 15, 20, 30, 50 years. They made a mistake when they were 18. They stabbed some guy in a bar or something. And they're really, really good students. So on Sunday, we're going to have a chaplain who runs the religious programs at one of the local prisons, state prison, I think, is going to come and tell us a little bit about his own experiences and tell us how we could participate. So a group of us have already been going to his prison and teaching meditation and yoga. And so what I'd like to do is have him come and give a little talk about his own experience. And then he will give us a brief training. And if you have that training, then you're allowed to go to the prison and teach yoga or meditation. We go in a group, There's absolutely no danger or anything like that. I mean, the first time I went, I was all, you know, ah. And I went with Lama Christie, and I said, oh, they're going to try to rape her or something, and she's pretty, and she's young, and, you know. And we went, and I was all like this, you know. And then they were very, very kind, very, very thoughtful. Their meditation is much better than any other group I've ever taught. You say, let's meditate, and it feels like a heavy curtain coming down, like, boom. And they go into it, you know. And so it's really fun. So Sunday, sign up for one of these programs. Because, you know, you're here because you want to learn to meditate, or you want to have some high spiritual experience. And one of the ways to make that happen is just plain old service of people who are messed up, or who need help, or who are just made a mistake once in their life, and they're lonely, and they need someone to pay attention to them. There's this beautiful part in the Bible, right, where Jesus said, I was lonely and you came to visit me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. And, you know, it's just a cool thing to do, and we should do it. If we have a group in Phoenix and we're doing cool stuff, some of it should be service, real service of real people, right? And not just sitting on our meditation mats somewhere, right? They go together. You succeed at meditation if you're helping people in a prison. You succeed at helping people in a prison if you meditate. Some of those guys from the earlier prisons are out, and they're very successful. One of them is teaching meditation in Phoenix, and very successful. So, okay. Nipa Shejeki Kun. Oh, wait, you're supposed to recite this. And we'll just go for another 10 minutes or 15 minutes. One, two, three.
Nipa Shejeki Kun Ke Hwa La. Teng Chen Ki Do Dam Ben Je Ki Shejeki Ke Hwa Dam. Teng Men Ki Doi.
Okay. We've been trying to establish that there are higher spiritual ideas that can prevent traffic in the first place, and then there are lower spiritual ideas which can help you cope with the traffic after it happens, all right? And obviously we'd like to prevent the traffic from coming in the first place. So he gave a whole presentation on those two levels of spiritual ideas. One was sort of, you could say, lower level spiritual ideas that help you cope with bad things. And then the highest spiritual idea, which gives you power to create a traffic-free lane through rush hour to the Mesa Church. Now watch tomorrow, something will happen. Anyway, he gave his presentation and he gave his ideas. And now, according to Buddhist tradition, he must back them up from some other authority from ancient times, all right? We're not allowed to speculate about things on our own. We have to prove them with logic, and then by tradition, we go back and we say, I got this from such and such an authority. So at this point in the text, he is going to put forth the authority for the ideas he's just presented about different levels of spiritual ideas that are either fixes or band-aids. All right? Here we go. Those of you who are learning Tibetan, which is like one of you, say Sheje.
Sheje.
What are the parts of that? What's Shepa? To know. What's Chepa? The second most common verb in every language?
To do.
To do. Okay? Shejay means to do, to know, to do knowing. It means, it's the Tibetan word, it's the Tibetan logic word for proof. Proof. That which makes you know. Okay? It's the word for proof. Okay? Sources which prove our points. Okay? Say kung.
Kung.
Kung means an authoritative source. Okay? So Ken Rinpoche, my lama, with whom I lived for 20 years, he was a little bit hot. And somebody would come up and say, oh, Rinpoche, I heard this thing about, you know, you should close your eyes and not think about anything and go into the cosmic void. And I think I saw a vortex when I last time I visited Sedona. And he was very polite. And he would say, oh, yes. And then he would give the person some tea and he'd smile. And they'd say, get back to me, you know, sometime. Then they would leave, they would close the door, and he'd look at me and he'd say, Lung Dang Kung Me Khen. Say, Lung
Dang
Kung Me Khen.
Lung
Dang
Kung
Me Khen. So, Lung means scriptural authority. Kung means authoritative source of scripture. Me Khen means a person who never heard of either one. You know, he would say, he would just roll his eyes and say, Lung Dang Kung Me Khen, you know. You know, like, what new thing did you make up this week, you know, like that. So in our tradition, you can say something like, you have to understand the ultimate reality of the traffic problem to fix the traffic permanently forever so that you don't have traffic to cope with. Okay? But then you have to prove that somebody big in the hundreds of years before said the same thing, or you are... Lung Dang Kung Me Khen. You are just a Lung Dang Kung Me Khen. Which in a monastery situation is considered disgraceful. You know, to say things, oh, I have a feeling that there's a vortex here. And I was like, Lung Dang Kung Me Khen. Okay, here we go. Here's second intersection. There are two parts here. Where we set our heart to prove the point. Sutras last part. And secondly, okay, so Buddhism went through two great periods in its history. In the first 7 centuries, first 700 years, because of some historical things, a system arose which did not emphasize helping the entire world. It emphasized you going into a cave and helping yourself, and meditating and like that. You could say sitting on your seat without going to the prison or to the Chandler Drug and Rehab Center to do it, all right? Then after the 3rd century AD, and some people believe, I'm one of them, that maybe under the influence of Christian ideas and Jewish ideas from the Middle East, there was a shift in Buddhist teachings that we call the Mahayana, which means the greater way. And there became more emphasis on compassion. Balancing your meditation practice with some time going to the prison, or things like that, all right? So, he's going to give proofs for his statements first from the classical texts, ancient texts of the greater way. And then he's going to go back earlier in time to the lower way, or the Theravada, which called the what does Theravada mean?
Way of the elders.
Saying elders, the elders way. You can say the elders way, all right? We're going to have proofs from modern Buddhism, which are only 18 centuries old, and then we will have proofs from older Buddhism, all right? Here we go. Point that we've been making all along, that we started earlier this afternoon, as the whole purpose of our presentation was to prove that, or was to speak about the way to get out of all forms of suffering. Say ge,
ga,
na,
chi.
Ge means the suffering of being reborn, which maybe you don't even accept. That's okay, we can skip that one. Ga means the suffering of aging, all right? And if you haven't experienced it yet, you will, all right? Things start to fall apart, things start to stop. You're like an old car now, all right? I have a 1980 Volvo, I know, you know? Things are always falling apart, you know? Just pieces fall off. Like every day I have to look through the car and see what fell off. And then I have to decide whether this is going to affect how the car runs or not, you know? I actually have a box where I keep all the pieces that fall off. And then if it's still running after a few weeks, I throw them out. And then, so, your body is the same, okay? It gets old, things stop working, things start getting... Your eyes don't work so good, your ears don't work so good, your hair falls out, your teeth get yellow, you know, you're on your fourth crown on the left side of top. And... that's the way it is. It falls apart. Kye ga, the second suffering is the aging of the body and the mind. Okay? Na means what?
Sickness.
Sickness. I mean, you can do yoga all you want. You know, you can eat healthy. Still, you get sick sometimes, you know? There's nothing sadder than to talk to somebody who says, I ate organic all my life, and I don't know why I got breast cancer. You know? Like, it happens. All right, it happens a lot. Okay, and then kega na chi, what's chi?
Death.
I mean, it's ironic. They tell you to spend your whole life working. You even get hassled if you don't work 50 weeks a year to have 2 weeks to yourself. They tell you to work for your whole life. You collect things, you buy a car, you buy a house, you buy clothes. You support your friends and relatives and family, and then you die, and you lose it all. In one day, in 1 hour, you lose it all, right? And then you think, well, it's not so bad, the kids will use it. The kids will spend it in 1 year. You know? The kids will sell the house in 1 year. Or they'll rent it, and the people will wreck it, and then they'll sell it. And it's used. It's just suffering. Right now our life is just suffering. Alright? The whole life is suffering. If you now this sentence says he starts out his kung, which means what? Lung dong kung. He starts out presenting the proofs for his previous statements from ancient scriptures by saying, it is the case that if you wish to stop those forces of aging and sickness and death itself, you must see how reality works. You must come to an understanding of how reality really works, or you have no hope. It's not possible. Okay? You must come to see how reality works. How does reality work? Your complaining husband didn't come from himself. Your complaining husband could only have come from your own complaining. All right? That's all. That's what I'm describing as the way reality works. Okay? Forget the way reality works. I'm talking about your husband. All right? If you don't come to understand where he came from and why he happens to be complaining, you will actually get old and you will die. All right? It's not just that you're going to change your complaining husband. That's nice. But you'll still get old and die, you see? With him. To see a devoted couple get old and die, one of them die on the other, and then the other one dies shortly after from a broken heart, really. It's almost less painful to see people get divorced at 40 or 50, you see? But to see them stick together and then one of them dies before the other, that's even worse. To me, that's even sadder, right? Understanding where your complaining husband really came from will not only stop him from complaining, it could stop you both from dying, okay? It could stop you both from death itself, all right? And from the process of aging itself. And that's interesting, right? That's more important. He's saying it's not possible to stop those problems unless you figure out where they're coming from on a very deep level, all right? Here we go. Okay, so you know, one of the most famous teachings of Buddhism, of all of Buddhism, is that things are not going to last, all right? Nothing lasts, all right? All the good things that you ever got in your life will fall away, right? Children will die on you. Houses will, get foreclosed on you. Cars will get old on you and break down, you know? Your own body will deceive you and die on you, you know? You can't hang on to anything because everything is changing, right? That is supposed to be one of the most fundamental teachings of all Buddhism. And that one realization that all things change is supposed to have profound effects on your happiness. If you can come to the realization that all things change and pass, then it's supposed to lift you to a higher plane of realization, even to nirvana itself, okay? But then our author says, those meditations on the fact that things pass away and all things change on you cannot lift you to the highest place by themselves. If you don't understand where things are coming from, okay? Meditating on how things are changing without understanding why things change is not going to help you, ultimately, all right? It's one thing to contemplate the fact that you have to lose everything. It's much different to contemplate on an understanding of why things change on you. What causes things to get old, right? And let's talk about that and we'll stop, all right? Let's talk about that, because I really like that subject. And for me, people ask me, why did you become a monk? And you know, if it's a newspaper, like Deutsche Financial Times, right, last month, they said, why did you become a monk? And I said, well, in my family, three people died in 1 year. Out of six people in my immediate family, my father, my mother, and my brother all died in the same year, you know? And then I was like, you know, what's the answer of life? Why is this happening? You know, why do people die? You know, to lose half your family in a single year at the age of 20, this is like, it's like the worst thing that could happen, right? And that thrust me into spiritual practice, and that's why I became monk. That's what I tell the newspapers, okay? Then my friends, they asked me, why did you become a monk? And I said, it was all this thing with girls, you know? It was all this thing with girls. And then they'd say, what do you mean, all this thing with girls? And I'd say, you know, I would meet a girl, and we would get to know each other, and I would really, really be attracted to them, and I'd think, this is the one, you know? Now I'm going to have a really, you know? All the ones in the past were at mistakes, and now I understand, now I'm much wiser, and now I have the right one, you know? And your heart goes pity-pat for the first few months. And then you have your first argument, right? And I remember my first argument, you know, and they're crying. And you're like angry at them, you know? I said, why are you crying? And they said, well, you did this, you know? And you're like, well, of course I did. I've been doing that all along. And you say, yeah, but you did it today. Or something irrational thing like that, you know? and then you're like, you know, cheer up, and I'll meet you later tonight, you know? And then that's your first argument. And then you have your second argument, then you have your third argument. Then there's a week when like 3 days out of seven you were arguing. And then there's a week where 7 days out of seven you were arguing, you know? And it just seemed to me, even at the age of 20, having been through, you know, only a few puerile relationships, that there was this cycle, this predictable cycle, you know? You feel all happy at the beginning, then you have your first argument, then you start to have more arguments, then you're like bickering each other all the time and you're treating each other really poorly, you know? Like you're saying things to each other that you would never say to anybody else. And then you're saying things to each other that you would never say to anybody else, but you're doing it all the time. You know, and then you go out in public to a party or something and you're smiling, you know, and then you get home and you start bitching again at each other. Christy and me used to call it scum talk, because we did a 3-year silent retreat and in the desert. And we collected like 7 skunks who used to come around to eat the extra food. If you stay silent for 6 months, the animals trust you and they come. And they talk to you. It's very beautiful. It's really beautiful. If you just shut up for 6 months, then they figure you can talk. You know. So anyway, they would get into fights sometimes over the food, and then you'd hear this thing. You hear. And then suddenly it stops, and there's this. And then this smell comes up in the air. This incredible, like, mustard gas thing comes up in the air. And then it rises to the floorboards of the yurt. And then for 2 days, the yurt smells like a skunk, you know? Because they had a fight. They finally decided to shoot each other. So then we discovered that we were doing skunk talk a lot of the time. So anyway, you do skunk talk for a while. And then you break up, you know? Actually, and then the person you dislike most in the world is the person you have the biggest crush on. It's very bad. It's very sad, and it's very much the way things go. I don't know about you, but I have seen this pattern by the time I was 20, that this is the way things go. And the person you dislike the most is the person you were the most in love with, supposedly, at the beginning. And then I became a monk in the search of answers about this phenomenon that the person you most like is the person you end up hating the most. Like, why is that? Because it happened to my parents, and I was there, and I was a little kid, and I was watching this violence go on, and then I was like, how can they, I know they like each other, why are they actually hitting each other? Why, you know? And so anyway, I became a monk to go explore this question. But I never tell that to the newspaper. Then what the Buddhists say about that is that the reason you meet an interesting person of the other sex or same sex, whatever you are, it doesn't matter. The reason you meet an interesting partner, potential partner, is that you have been kind to the elderly. You have been kind to lonely people. Okay? A seed was planted in your mind when you went to the nursing home and you spent some time to take care of an elderly person there. I have a date tomorrow. Me and Mrs. Hancock are going to the elderly center for exercise. She's 85. And then Friday, she invited me to a turkey dinner. I'm not sure. We have to see if I have time, okay? But you help a lonely person, right? And then when you help them, when you go out to a turkey dinner together, then that plants a seed in your mind. That plants a karmic seed in your mind. Then you go to Starbucks, you're working on your computer, but really you're looking at the door to see if somebody cute comes in. Or you're at a yoga class, you know, trying to figure out who's not attached to somebody else. Like, the first one you see always has a boyfriend. And then you have to go to the number two. But anyway, so what makes a boy show up at Starbucks and sit down right next to you to work on his laptop is, and then gaze at you over the top, is that you help the lonely people in the nursing home. You see? It's like the pen thing, right? I got a pen because I shared a pen with him. I have a seed in my mind that causes me to see a person walk into Starbucks on a night that I'm lonely and sit next to me because there's no other chair available, right? Nothing is random. Nothing is accident. You didn't meet the last person you ever got attached to by accident. They came in and sat down next to you because you were helping lonely people in the past. And that put a karmic seed in your mind, all right? By your meeting them, that seed opens. The meeting of them is the opening of the seed, right? Okay? The meeting of them is the opening of that seed. The seed has matured in the mind, in the soil of the mind, and it has opened by meeting them. What happens to the seed of an oak tree? The acorn, right? 1 gram acorn creates a 3-ton oak tree. You know that. But what happens to the acorn when the tree grows? The growth of the tree destroys the acorn. You see? The growth of the tree destroys the acorn. The growth of each of those pots of flowers destroyed the seed from which they grew. Because it has to feed on that material, right? It draws the... It's the same with your body. You came from the seed of your mother and the sermon. The semen of your father. The egg of your mother and the seed of your father. Two cells created, billions of cells, which have replicated for 30, 40, 50 years. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. One acorn, a gram, creates an oak tree which weighs 3 tons. But what I'm talking about is that the growth of the oak tree kills the acorn. You see? The growth of the oak tree destroys the acorn. The meeting of the boy and then the going out on a date with the boy destroys the karmic seed that you created by helping the lonely people at the nursing home. Okay? So it's not your fault that you hate them. Now, got it? That's all I have to say. I felt so happy to find that out. You see? It's not your fault. The growth of the relationship killed the cause of the relationship, you see? Every hour that you spend with your newfound love is destroying the seed which brought them to you. You see? Every hour you spend is using up more of the seed's material. And then it must go downhill. It must go downhill. Right? Because the existence of the relationship kills the material from which it came, which is that you visited lonely people. Is there a way to outsmart this process?
Yes.
Just what? Go to the nursing home with your new boyfriend. See? Like, get you and your new boyfriend go to the nursing home together. And you help people, and you plant new seeds. And then your relationship gets sweeter and sweeter. And you can do that. I've done that with some friends for like 40 years. Okay? Whenever we are together, we go help some old person. And the relationship has gotten better year after year for many, many decades, right? Better than the beginning, right? 40 years ago. So that's just a comment about understanding the nature of change itself. What is the emptiness of change itself? You see? What is the deep reality behind change itself? The reality behind change itself also comes from karmic seeds. Right? Things wear out because the seed wears out. If you don't like it, then plant new seeds. Keep planting seeds. I call it reinvestment. You can get rich. I don't know if you all know, I made the fastest growing company in the history of New York City in my spare time while I was doing the Geshe course, okay? In my spare time. It was bought by Warren Buffett last year. It's now a $250 million company. It's more than the combined economy of Southern Arizona, okay? You start a business, you get a little bit of money. You take that money, you split it. You use some of it yourself, and you give the rest of it to some poor people to help somebody who needs money, right? That creates a new karmic seed. It's a reinvestment, you get it? That creates a new karmic seed, and then you get double back. My company doubled every year for 15 years. It's a record in New York City. You get the money back, what do? Split it, reinvest some of it in poor people, help poor people. Then next year you get double the profits. What do you do with that money? Split it and reinvest it, right? You help an elderly, lonely person because you want a new boyfriend to make you less lonely. Got it? You meet them. What should you do with them? Split the time, give some of the time to more elderly people. You see? And then your relationship will get stronger. And the love will get more intense. You'll be more tight than you were the year before. Okay? And your happiness level will go up. What do you do then? Split it again. You see? Undertake to help more elderly people. You see, get it? Never stop the reinvestment process, all right? And then you can outsmart the mechanism which creates death itself, the mechanism which creates all change itself, by reinvesting your goodness, all right? Got it? It's cool. I learned the answer to the girlfriend problem in the monastery. No, it was nice. I mean, I got what I was looking for, right? And I'm sharing it with you, and it's beautiful. And you can have... You don't have to be afraid of a relationship. You can enter a relationship with confidence now, because then you just go serve other people with your partner, and you invest some of your happy time with people who are lonely, and then that relationship. Don't think that because you had 10 failed relationships, number 11 has to be failed. It's not true. You just didn't know about the acorn thing. And now you do. So you can change things. You and your partner go help some lonely people and make it a policy. And it will keep getting sweeter and sweeter. And you will outsmart the impermanence thing. All right? If you simply meditate on the impermanence of relationships, what will happen? Basically, that's the old Buddhist, that's the low Buddhist school idea of, oh, go sit in a cave and give up on relationships because they can't work. Okay? He says that's not a spiritual fix. That's what he's saying in this sentence, all right? Meditations on things like impermanence cannot bring you to nirvana if you don't understand where things are coming from. If you do understand where things are coming from, and then you meditate on permanence, you can outsmart impermanence. Got it? It's cool, right? So don't just go doing impermanence meditations. You have to do them with an understanding of seeds. And then the whole thing turns around and you can use it to be happy. Okay? Why not have a nice boy and be happy? What's wrong with that? It's not a bad thing. That's a nice thing. Okay? Good night. Tomorrow we'll start the regular class, okay? This is like a 7-year thing, so don't get overwhelmed. Tomorrow we will continue the class on how to meditate and what to meditate on. Okay? Good night.
You're welcome.